For a few years from 2014, ISIS ruled a little state known as the Caliphate, straddling the border of Iraq and Syria, where about 8 million people lived under brutal Sharia law. ISIS followers came from all over the world to join the regime, and the Caliphate became the home base of terrorism worldwide. When the Caliphate was wiped out in 2019, ISIS was no longer so much in the headlines, but it did not disappear. A new phase of operations began, more scattered, still violent, still a danger around the world, even, it seems, in Australia. To discuss ISIS today, I'm joined by Professor Greg Barton, Chair in Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University. Greg, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Greg, what has ISIS always been on about?
Well, I think we need to understand, David, that ISIS came out of Al-Qaeda. It was a splinter of Al-Qaeda. It could well have remained in Al-Qaeda, but for some differences of personality and clashes when it transitioned to Syria. But I say that Al-Qaeda is important because Al-Qaeda began almost 40 years ago. So this has been a long journey. And of course, the Al-Qaeda story began with what was the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt taking up roots in Saudi Arabia decades earlier, and then finally Osama bin Laden emerging as the face of a resistance movement that really established itself in the 1980s with the so-called Mujahideen fighting Soviet military occupation of Afghanistan. And everything that's come since then has its roots back in that formative period, including ISIS.
And this is a fairly common story, isn't it, of movements of this kind splintering?
Yes, I mean, whether it's sort of violent movements or whether it's just sort of regular mainstream religious movements, I mean, religious movements and social movements in general do tend to splinter because they tend to be led by charismatic individuals who want to, you know, stamp their mark, normally men, of course, and often fall out with others. In the case of Al-Qaeda, then ISIS, you've had a series of really significant charismatic leaders. Bin Laden was certainly a significant figure, if not a scholar. And then Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who led Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that became Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, fell out with his protege, who is now heading up the new government in Syria, as it happens. The man that we knew as Jawlani, whose actual name is Ahmed Ashara, fell out with Zarqawi, and we then saw ISIS split off from Al-Qaeda. But this is a familiar pattern of behavior, but there's a lot of resilience and persistence in this Al-Qaeda / ISIS movement, so we shouldn't be surprised that it's still around.
But Greg, why would somebody want to be an ISIS warrior? What did the warriors hope to get out of service to this movement?
That's a really good question, David. And a lot of the people who are charged now with being part of the movement, when questioned, would say they weren't a warrior. They were just a cook, a bottle washer, a driver. But I think at the time that the physical caliphate existed, it was a utopian project. So some people went there out of a romantic ideal that they were being part of a brave new society. Others, younger men in particular, went because they were attracted to the violence and the sense of being part of something exciting. This, of course, in Al-Qaeda, but certainly in ISIS, was an apocalyptic movement. So it believed itself at the end of history, and this was going to precipitate a sort of Armageddon final clash. And different elements there appeal to different people, but I've certainly spoken to women who went off to Syria thinking they were joining a utopian political project, only to be bitterly disappointed. And clearly their attraction was different from young men who wanted to be part of didn't actually want to be warriors, wanted to be part of a fight.
But the history of utopian projects is pretty bloody and horrible, isn't it?
Sadly, the history of utopian projects, but also I think, and it helps to understand that before Al-Qaeda, you had the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and it sort of took what was essentially a Marxist idea of revolution and applied it in a religious context. And that's the DNA that went on to be part of Al-Qaeda and then Islamic State, or ISIS. And that idea of revolution, I mean, it's very hard to think of any revolutions in modern history that have ended well, however much they seem to promise at the outset.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But what were the enemies of ISIS? I mean, who was ISIS supposed to be defeating?
Well, we're talking about a fundamentalist religious movement. So in a sense, anyone who wasn't with them was an enemy. And that included Sunni Muslims. They were a Sunni Muslim fundamentalist group, but Sunni Muslims who didn't agree with their extreme ideas were in the first instance enemies. Shia Muslims who differed with them sort of more obviously were enemies. Christians and other groups living in Syria, Iraq were enemies. But they picked up the Al-Qaeda idea because it was Al-Qaeda at the outset of the far enemy. So the far enemy was America, Israel, etc., and all of America's allies. And that came out of that formative period in the 1980s, fighting the Soviet military occupation of Afghanistan. Many people went there to help, they thought, the Afghans. But when they ended up joining what became Al-Qaeda, they were told, your job is to learn and study here, to learn how to fight, but to take your fight back home, because this is about a global struggle and you're fighting the far enemy. That was the innovation that distinguished the way that bin Laden was taking Al-Qaeda at the time. And that's remained a theme ever since. So you've got a, now you have a tension between lots of local conflicts, lots of disaffected groups, particularly I'm thinking of Africa at the moment, and groups like either Al-Qaeda, which is still active, or ISIS, coming along and saying, actually, your local struggle is part of a global struggle. Come and join us and we'll help you defeat your local problems, but also you'll be part of a global solution. So that far enemy idea is a critical element, but it begins with trying to pick up people who have often quite legitimate local grievances with the governments of the nation that they're in or the region that they're in. And it tends to be exacerbated when you've got a breakdown of good governance. So these groups don't get much traction in states that are functioning fairly well, but where states are beginning to fail. And you think about the sort of history of modern history of Syria, Iraq, particularly after the invasion of 2003, Afghanistan, Somalia, etc. These are the sort of failing state situations where a group like Al-Qaeda or ISIS can put down roots, because there's a lot of disaffected people who have, you know, in many ways, legitimate grievances. And the hope is to try and turn those legitimate grievances into them finding common cause. Making that jump to a global struggle is much harder, though, thankfully. Otherwise, there'd be more of a problem than there currently are.
What was the point, though, of carrying out an operation like the slaughter at the Bataclan Theatre in Paris? And what was supposed to follow from it? 130 people killed. It was one of the deadliest attacks in Western Europe in a very long time. But what was supposed to, how was it supposed to help the aims of ISIS?
Yep, that is a really good question, David. I think part of the answer, I'm not saying all of the answer, but part of the answer comes in thinking about what happened with the 9/11 attack and other great, large-scale terror attacks. If we ask ourselves, why do groups do outrageous things? And, well, you know, part of the answer is to provoke outrage. It's how we respond to a terrorist attack that determines ultimately how much impact it's going to have. The 9/11 attacks were truly outrageous, and in that sense of outrage, we ended up embarking on a so-called global war on terror that ran for a couple of decades without any clear strategic aim. So in that sense, there's a certain logic in being outrageously provocative. But of course, at another level, it's hard to see how any, you know, how could you possibly justify attacking strangers, perhaps fellow Muslims, but certainly just ordinary citizens, or civilians, non-combatants, in the way that occurred in the Bataclan Theatre or, any number of other such attacks on a smaller scale.
So in the hope that the French would overreact as the Americans did and expose the state to damage?
Yeah, and that unfortunately is a mechanism that works. I mean, the obvious recent example is the awful Hamas attacks of October 7th, 2023. That was truly those attacks were outrageous. They provoked outrage. And in some ways, that was what, in that case, Hamas wanted. So, and that's picking up in that same family of Al-Qaeda, ISIS extremism. So the violence, I think for some of the participants, is part of the point that they're attracted to violence. There's that whole aspect of it. But to dismiss them as madmen or just intoxicated on violence is to miss the point that if you do something outrageous and you provoke a response, perhaps a miscalculated response, which certainly happens, then you can achieve much more than by any other mechanism.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Greg Barton, the Chair of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, about the current strategy, tactics and whereabouts of ISIS. Greg, in 2014, when the caliphate had only just been established and was, you know, perhaps at its most powerful, the order went out to lone actors to operate where you are with what you have. And is that still the kind of fundamental tactic of ISIS?
Sadly, it is, David. It's not the only thing they're doing. I mean, in Africa, they're operating in an insurgent mode, and they're moving into areas of failing governance and buying into local grievance. But, you know, sad to say, and I, you know, obviously we have to wait for the full investigation into the Bondi terror attack, but it would appear we certainly had a couple of what appears to be a couple of lone actors apparently inspired by ISIS. And that certainly fits with the September 2014 call to, if you can't come and join us, fight where you are, use what you have, you know, use a rock or a gun or use your car. That's a pattern that's been repeated. It was immediately responded on within 2 days in Melbourne with a young Afghan boy, unfortunately, who stabbed two police officers and was shot dead in the process.
That was an immediate response to that call, was it?
Yeah, I'm not saying that that call was the only thing that triggered that attack, but it was an immediate response. And then, of course, the Lent Cafe siege in December that year, 2014, was more of that same. We saw the murder of the New South Wales police accountant Curtis Cheng, just leaving the office, Parramatta Police Headquarters, on a normal day, and was gunned down, wrong place, you know, wrong time. But that was another lone actor attack that was inspired by this call. That if you go and do something in our name, the ISIS leadership said, we'll make sure that you are a martyr. That happened to Nauman Haider, the young Afghan boy. It happened to man Harun Monis, who led the Lint Cafe siege, Dabiq magazine, the ISIS E magazine immediately praised them as heroes. And that's the social contract. Do something in our name, you go from zero to hero, and we'll make sure you're remembered. It's a powerful message to those who are particularly vulnerable, looking for recognition. And it, you know, particularly if that individual has other problems where that motivation rings, you know, it's a siren song calling them to do something. There's always going to be some people who will find that attractive, unfortunately. So you can see why ISIS would double down on that method. And lone actor attacks is hard to stop.
And you don't have to wait for orders.
No, that's right. You don't need to be part. If you're part of a, you know, elaborate cell communicating, planning, the fair chance of those communications being detected. Modern police counterterrorism intelligence works really well in detecting those sort of elaborate long-term plans. What is very hard to see coming is a lone actor where one or two individuals just decide to do something and they haven't talked to anyone else about it, at least not that you've picked up.
And if you are a martyr, what does that mean? I mean, you know, if you seek martyrdom, there is a life to come. There are rewards in that life.
Yeah, for some individuals, there's a sense that they're not only are they going from zero to hero in terms of making a name for themselves, but that often the way young men are sort of persuaded, seduced into doing this is to say, look, you've made a mess of your life, your relationships, substance abuse, your work, everything's gone wrong for you, but just do this one thing and all that will be washed away. So in that kind of religious fundamentalist understanding, they're told that all their sins will be absolved. It'll be an act of redemption. Do this one thing and a lifetime of mistakes and disappointments will be replaced by you remembered as somebody who's done something glorious. And in some cases, there's also the sense that, well, this is going to help my mum and my dad and my sister, because they'll also sort of get a dispensation for a forgiveness of sins as well. So it plays out for different individuals in different details, but there is this notion of it being a redemptive act, as, you know, horrible as it is to think that an act of terrible violence, generally against strangers, is a redemptive act.
And somehow revved up by the fame that it will bring as well.
Yeah, and I've, you know, everything I've just said largely applies to far right actors who are revved up by the fame. The zero to hero thing is strongly appeals to them, but perhaps not the religious dimension, and certainly not the martyrdom. So think of the young man from New South Wales who went off to Christchurch and then shot dead 51 people at Friday prayers in two mosques in March of 2019. He certainly didn't want to die, as far as we can see, but he wanted to live stream his event and post his manifesto so that he would be seen as a hero. And he was following somebody who had done something very similar in Norway in July 2011, and that's a pattern that's been repeated on the far right. So the psychology of this, you know, transcends religious doctrine. But in the case of those who are following ISIS, there's also this religious element of, you know, actual redemption and atonement for sins, as it were, through this zero to hero act.
And an implacable opposition, I take it, to Israel.
Israel is often one of the justifying calls, and of course that's been the case for decades. It's sort of grown in sort of sharpness since the horrible October 7th, 2023 Hamas attacks and the subsequent tragic responses that's cost so many lives since. But I think one of the appeals of Israel, it was one of those things that people who otherwise couldn't agree on much could agree on: a common enemy. And it was a religious minority that was different. It was, I mean, the idea that historically Jews and Muslims were always sworn enemies is not true. For most of history, that was simply not the case.
Yes.
Nor were Sunnis and Shia Muslims sworn enemies. But in the narrative of Al-Qaeda then is and ISIS, this has been one of the easiest bits of narrative to run with. And of course, the last few years has made it even easier.
You are one of this country's experts on ISIS. Looking at Bondi, do you see that as an ISIS operation? Is that a lone actor, ISIS-inspired operation, as far as you can tell, knowing what we know so far?
Yeah, knowing what we know so far, which is an important caveat, based on what we think we know, or seeing what seems reasonably likely to be proven true once it's investigated, yes, it certainly fits the pattern of a lone actor attack. Allegedly, there are two individuals, but that still fits the definition of lone actors, one or two, maybe even three, but not networked, not following a hierarchical command structure. And they certainly made claims that they're acting in the name of ISIS. It fits that pattern. And I think we'll probably find when we've properly investigated this, that's what will be decided as demonstrated to be true beyond reasonable doubt. But we still need to get to the bottoms of the details of it, but it fits a familiar pattern.
Is it also a pattern that ISIS operatives or people who see themselves as, you know, lone actors for ISIS, do they have any interest at all in newspaper dialogue about the politics of Israel? Do they have any interest at all in what goes on university campuses, discussing, you know, disputes there about what Israel should or shouldn't be doing? Do they have any interest in actually anti-Semitism itself?
Well, I think certainly attacking Jews at a Jewish event, you know, fits the definition of anti-Semitism, but that doesn't mean that it's the same as other kinds of anti-Semitism. And I think, to your point of your question, there is a big difference between discussions on campus, popular protests, and the sort of horrific violence that is associated with ISIS. They are quite different things. They intersect at some points of narrative, perhaps, or at least appear to, but actually they're driven by quite different mechanisms, I would argue. From what we know of at least what we think we know about the Bondi attack, there was a process of radicalization that goes back many years, well before, recent troubles in Gaza, for example. And, you know, there's a bigger question there about what was missed and whether there was a interrupted radicalization trajectory or whether it was just something that was going on for, you know, more than a decade. But that's a very different, and there's a temptation to conflate these things and say it's all the same thing. And anti-Semitism and particularly violent attacks on Jews are awful things in themselves, but not everything that takes that pattern is the same thing or has the same causes. And it's really important we understand what the causes are, because we want to try and prevent them happening in future.
Indeed. And to be clear, I agree with you absolutely that the attack at Bondi was an anti-Semitic outrage. But my question was looking to the causes of it, which, as I understand from your answer, is that it goes way back beyond anything that's happening in Australia to grudges and hatreds from another place, another time.
That's right. It's not dependent on recent events and recent politics in Israel or elsewhere. And there is an opportunism to, framing an attack on a minority, whether it's Jews or whether it's another group, and then trying to justify what you're doing in your manifesto and your statement on the basis of mistakes that have been made or current politics. Generally, the motivational trajectory goes back well before that. Having said that, what's been happening the last, the tragic events of the last few years in Israel, in Gaza, in the West Bank, now in Lebanon, the worry is that this will be picked up and used, weaponized as a powerful narrative hook to try and get another generation of people engaged in violence. So there is the potential for this to generate terrorist violence in itself. But I think what happened in Bondi, as far as we can tell, had its roots way earlier and no direct connection with recent politics or recent events.
Greg, is the greatest danger that ISIS presents that these lone operators, as you were suggesting before, are very hard to detect? They're just operating on their own.
They're operating on their own, but they feel themselves to be part of a global virtual community, if not sort of a face-to-face community of people that they know. They want to be seen as part of this community. They want to be seen to be acting in the name of ISIS. This also applies to some other extremist groups, but they want that sense of association, but they're going ahead and doing what they do without consulting others, not following orders. They're not communicating, and therefore if they're not communicating, by definition, we can't pick up communications. And that normal opportunity that comes with police counterterrorism intelligence is not there simply because they've not gone that route. There are some interesting details about what appears to be the case with the Bondi attack that suggests an attempt to reach out to ISIS people in southern Philippines and possibly in Afghanistan. And that sort of speaks to the fact that these people may be operating alone, but they still want to have a blessing, have a sense of recognition that what they're doing is, part of some holy cause in their own mind. So the social aspect's important, but because they're operating alone, it's very hard to see it coming.
Is ISIS stronger now than it's been lately?
ISIS is stronger than anyone would like it to be. If we were in the Sahel in northern and sub-Saharan Africa, where they're in competition with Al-Qaeda in places like Mali, or still a presence in places like Mozambique, a fairly recent presence, we'd be seeing them as potentially, in the worst case, an existential threat. But in places like Australia, indeed our region, Indonesia, where I am at the moment, I've just come back from some time in Lombok where I spoke to Indonesian counterterrorism police and former terrorists that they're working with to rehabilitate. There the story is that it's not an existential threat, the threat's under control, but it's still unfortunately a threat that takes up many more resources and presents a more resilient problem than you would wish it to be. And for places like Australia or indeed Southeast Asia, it's the lone actor attacks that will, for the foreseeable future, be a remaining threat. And this is in the age of not just the internet, but also social media. So something happening in sub-Saharan Africa goes out in a video in real time to people's phones around the world, and they can look at that and say, well, these are my guys, they're winning, I want to be part of it, I'm going to do something where I am. And we've got no easy answers for that. I mean, our news cycle may have forgotten ISIS, but those who are following them or those who are being touched by its propaganda haven't forgotten them. And, there are parts of the world where there's still a real formidable presence, and that means that they're generating propaganda for other parts of the world. And that's a problem that's not going to quickly go away.
Greg, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Greg Barton, Chair of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University, about the continuing challenge of ISIS.